Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, September the 12th, day number 255 of 2014. Today we're going to catch up with our good friend Victor Trey. We're going to talk about Pedro Pan. The story of Pedro Pan, as you know, Victor has written several books. He was one of the first authors to study Pedro Pan. This was in the late 90s, I believe, and he's written a fine book about Pedro Pan. And, you know, with so many anniversaries, 50-year-old anniversaries, you know, when it starts getting that old, I hate to say that old, but when you're celebrating 50 anniversaries of anything, it's obviously a time for reflection and to look back at this great program, Pedro Pan, that brought 14,000 children to the United States, including many of our friends, many that we've had on the show many, many times, like Fernando Hernandez and so on in Miami. So we're going to check out Pedro Pan today with our friend Victor Trey. Just a quick plug, the music at the beginning from my good friend Carlos Guedes. He's from Venezuela, and he's playing around town this week. So if you have a chance to go to the to go watch him play, he's really great. He plays the harp and has a little band, and it's just absolutely, absolutely wonderful. If you're the kind of person who likes to read books, well, then you read books. But if you're the kind of person who doesn't have time, you're driving around, you're in sales, you're a busy mom, sometimes a busy dad, you know, driving around town and driving here and driving there, then we're going to recommend audible.com. Go check the link on the show information. Click on that link, and it'll take you to their website, and you're going to be very impressed with their collection of audio books. You can just download one and listen to it the next time you're driving around or you're going somewhere or maybe you're flying or whatever it may be. Audible.com. And if you get yourself a book, you're going to make my day. How is that for a challenge? We're going to take a break, and we have Victor right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. We always like to go back and quickly check on this day in history. Well, on this day in 1953, a young senator by the name of John Kennedy and a young woman named Jackie were married in Rhode Island. John Kennedy would become president 7 years later and very much involved in the story of Cuba and the story that impacted so many of us. So John Kennedy and Jackie were married on this day in 1953. Let me say hello to Victor. How are you, Victor?
I'm doing great, Sylvia. How are you, my friend?
Absolutely great. You know, I was just mentioning John and Jackie Kennedy being married on this day. It's amazing how much Cuba played a role in his presidency. It almost became the defining issue of his presidency with, of course, sure, the Bay of Pigs and the missile crisis and everything else. Sometimes surprises happen.
Theories concerning his assassination as well.
That's right. So it seems like Cuba was all over the story of the Kennedy presidency. And, you know, I wonder how much he thought about that, you know, when he was running for office. Probably not a lot, I would think.
Yeah. Well, I think when he was running, Cuba was a theme during the campaign, and it's something that actually became controversial later because Eisenhower was in power at the time, or was president at the time, I should say, and Richard Nixon was his vice president, and Richard Nixon, the vice president, was the one running against Kennedy, and Richard Nixon knew full well exactly what the Eisenhower administration was doing in helping Cubans to overthrow Fidel Castro. Namely, they were already training Brigade 2506 in Guatemala for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Of course, Nixon, the candidate, knew of this because he was vice president but couldn't reveal it during the campaign for security reasons. So during their debates, when they would ask about Cuba, Kennedy, and not only during their debates, but, just part of the Kennedy campaign, was to say that the Eisenhower administration and, by extension, Richard Nixon, the vice president, weren't doing anything about the Cuba threat. And he really bludgeoned Nixon with this. You people aren't doing anything about Cuba, which, in fact, they were, but Nixon just couldn't say anything about it. And that's part of what won Kennedy the election. And then, of course, as soon as he became president, he found out exactly what they had been doing. And then he, ironically, he became very apprehensive and did what he did, and the invasion resulted in a disaster thanks to his decision.
That's right. It's just interesting how those things, how sometimes, especially if there's an incumbent, or the challenger, I should say, has the advantage of throwing stuff against the wall, whereas the incumbent has to be a little bit more careful because he knows what's going on behind closed doors. But, Victor, why don't we take a minute? I know you've been on the show many times. But why don't we take a minute and talk about you and just give us a little story, the Victor story, as I like to say.
Oh, well, I'll only tell you the nice parts.
All right. Don't tell me you're a Yankee fan.
Well, I am a Yankee fan, which, I know you're a Rangers fan, but neither one of us has any right to celebrate this year. But anyway, I was born in Miami. My parents left Cuba in 1960, along, with most of the rest of my family. And I was born in Miami in 1966 and raised in Miami, part of the, Cuban-American community down there, I suppose. I mean, Miami was a little bit, actually, Miami was very different back then when I grew up than what it is now. And I graduated high school in 1984 and then went on to college and got my PhD in history. And focused most of my research and writing on the Cuba issue, more specifically on Cuban exiles, because it was such a rich treasure of sources. And of course, and I also had an insider's knowledge, and so I was motivated to write about those things and fill some of the gaps that existed historically. And mostly because, a lot of the stuff in English that had been written about Cuban Americans and Cuban exiles had been written by people who weren't Cuban. And so hopefully that was my small contribution to the field.
Well, it's a big contribution because not only you wrote about Pedro Pan, we'll talk about that today, but you've also written a couple of novels. I think there's three of them, right? The first two are out.
Well, it's a trilogy. Two of them are out. The third one should be out in November.
And it's a story of a Cuban family caught up in the events of the early 60s, events that impacted people in so many different ways.
Absolutely.
And I know when that third one comes out, you got to let us know so that we can bring you in and talk about that one.
Of course.
But one of the things that happened in the early 1960s, and it's something that I have to confess a lot of Cubans did not know about, and even Cubans in the United States, like myself growing up here, I never really caught on with the Pedro Pan story until the late 90s, when I don't know who wrote something about it. I don't know. Somebody wrote an article about it, and even the name Pedro Pan, I think, became used at that time for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I've been fascinated by it, and I'm so grateful to you because you took the time to write a book and do the research. So let's start with what got you interested in the Pedro Pan story. You're obviously interested in the Cuban story, but specifically the Pedro Pan story. What got you interested in it?
Right. Well, you said something I think that was very important in that you had never heard of Pedro Pan until the late 90s. Neither had most people who were part of Operation Pedro Pan. What they knew is that their parents somehow got their hands on some visa waivers or other exit documents, more likely visa waivers. They were put on a plane by themselves. And when they got to Miami, maybe they just went with some relatives and got together with their parents later when their parents left, or some who didn't have relatives, about half of them, were sent to a camp in Miami and maybe later to to a boarding school in Iowa, and that's all they knew. I don't think they realized, most of them definitely did not realize that they were part of what was until that point and until very recently the largest migration of unaccompanied children in the history of the Western Hemisphere. They just knew their part. And I think what started to happen is that in the 90s, people became more aware. Operation Pedro Pan Group in Miami was created. I think Father Monsignor Brian Walsh, who was the head of the program, who passed away several years ago, was trying to get some of the kids together. And it was really an amazing thing because, you know, a lot of people who are now part of the Operation Pedro Pan group and are self-identified Pedro Pangs didn't realize that they were Pedro Pangs. They didn't realize they'd been part of this program because it was, semi-secret. And I don't think that they fully understood that they were part of something so big. And I can't tell you the number of people that I've told them they were Pedro Pangs because,
right.
And even some who knew about Pedro Pang and knew about my book, I started talking to them and asked them a few questions. And I said, well, you better go check the database, the Miami Herald, because I think you might find your name there. And then they do.
Right.
It's unlike any other thing in, during that period. If you were in Brigade 2506 and you were in the Bay of Pigs invasion, you knew you were in Brigade 2506 and you knew you were in the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Right.
You could have been part of this other very significant historical event and not known that you were part of it. And even people who knew a little bit more, maybe not actual Pedro Pangs, you would hear stories, parents who just put their kids on airplanes in the early 60s to get them out of Cuba. And that was about the extent of it. And it never had a context. And I don't think people realized that it had an organizational context. And by the late and by the 90s, they did. And I just happened to be, in around 1993, 94, in graduate school, and searching for a dissertation topic, and I was already living in Connecticut and doing the last part of my PhD at Florida State from Connecticut, and I was all ready to do a dissertation on Al Capone in Florida, which I can't even begin to tell you how difficult that was from Connecticut, especially in the days before the Internet. And then my brother, my brother is a journalist with CBS News, and a friend of his worked for CNN in Spanish, and they had just interviewed Mongo Grau. And Mongo Grau was one of the chief people in Operation Pedro Pan, and he was a longtime prisoner in Cuba as well, political prisoner. And I remember where it was. We were in his driveway. I was getting ready to leave his house, and he said, well, why don't you do it on Operation Pedro Pan? And my response was, what's that? And then he told me what he knew. And then, I went out, did some research, looked around, and realized no one had ever written a book about this.
Right.
And so I proposed it to my graduate committee. They accepted it. I wrote it as a dissertation. It was, everything went, fine with flying colors. And then I rewrote it and did some more research and submitted it as a book manuscript to the University Press of Florida, thinking I didn't have, I was very young at the time, I was still in my 20s, thinking I had no chance that anyone would ever take an interest in the largest movement of unaccompanied minors in the history of the Western Hemisphere, right? I look back now, and it's almost funny, because now I look back and I see, well, of course they accepted it for publication, how could they not? But at the time, sure. You're young, and people who write books are these people who live on the top of some mountain meditating all day, and you never see them. And then, very quickly they accepted it, and it turned out to be my first book.
Well, it's a fascinating book. Go ahead.
And of all my books, I think it's the one still that has made the most waves and is, certainly the one that has gotten, I think, the larger reaction even, in Cuba. Of course, the only people there who've read it are, government officials. But they've, commented on it, not in a positive way, of course, but, that got to them a little bit. So,
well, when the Cuban government reacts, when the Cuban government reacts negatively about a book, then that must mean that it's a pretty good book.
Right. Right, exactly.
But, I mean, they obviously don't like your book for obvious reasons, but I would say that the for me personally, the Pedro Pan topic, as I said, I learned about it in the late 90s, became a little bit more interested in the last couple of years, in large part because I began to make friends who were Pedro Pan you know, kid, like Fernando down in Miami, like
right.
Amarilis, and we had, you know, we had Nilda Cepero recently on the show, and these were all Pedro Pan kids who have now grown up here. Of course, there's others like Mel Martinez and people like that who made it to the U.S. Senate. So I really became interested in recently, Victor, as you know, there have been some significant anniversaries, the 50th anniversary, actually 54th anniversary of when the program
right.
started. Then there are some streets in Miami now that are being named after
right.
Pedro Pan. So it has now gotten to the point where it is now, how can I put it, it's like a chapter in the Cuban-American story. I always think of you and me and all of us Cuban-Americans that, you know, we're this gigantic book and all of us have chapters in it. And I think
mm-hmm.
the Pedro Pan chapter, thanks to your efforts and the efforts of others in Miami who've kept the story alive, it's a big
mm-hmm.
chapter now. I mean, I've always felt that in the future, I mean, 25, 30 years from now, when Cuba is free again and people in Cuba can look at all of this again, that I think the Pedro Pan story is going to be mesmerizing for future Cuban generations here and in Cuba, because it's a little bit like the Spanish Civil War. You know, it never
mm-hmm.
ceases to the Spanish Civil War never ceases to amaze people. I mean, here
yeah.
we are almost 70 years later, and people are still captivated by it. Or even the American
yeah.
Civil War, the same thing. So I have
Absolutely.
A funny feeling that there's going to be this renaissance of interest in Pedro Pan
yeah.
in the future. Because, as you say, it's 14,000 kids. I mean, the idea
sure. –
well, you and I are fathers. I mean, the idea – my kids are a little bit older than yours, but nevertheless, the idea of taking your kids to an airport and putting them in a plane and saying, we'll see you later – even if you knew you
right.
were only going to be separated for a few months, that had to be very tough on those parents.
Definitely. Definitely.
I mean, I've seen the videos of parents crying. I mean, it had to be horrible, Victor.
Yeah, no, it really was. I mean, I think most of them, you know, assumed or allowed themselves to assume that this was going to be for a short time. We'll all be reunited here in Cuba after the government falls. A lot of them, you know, just kind of, and I have the character in one of my books do this, because I'd heard this story so many times, you know, just convince themselves that they're just going to the United States to study. And as you know, in pre-revolutionary Cuba, it wasn't uncommon for, you know, middle class and up parents to send their kids, you know, abroad to study, especially to the United States. My own grandfather spent, you know, most of his adolescence at the petty school in New Jersey. I mean, that was pretty normal. And so it's okay. Well, we're just sending them. They're going to learn English. You know, they're going to go to school there. You know, there and even the terms in the camps, when you would go to the camp, and they would send you to your permanent placement, right? Because there were transit camps in Miami for those kids who didn't have relatives, and they would spend some time at the camps. And then they'd often be sent away to a permanent placement somewhere, to a foster home, to a boarding school, an orphanage, whatever. And they called those placements at the camps, they called them becas. And a beca means a scholarship.
That's right.
Right? So that's how ingrained I think the perception was, or maybe the you know, self-deception, I don't know what to call it, was that they were here studying. But everybody knew, you know, right underneath the surface that – this wasn't really about study. This was, you know, fleeing the government, fleeing indoctrination, fleeing danger. And it was very hard for the parents because, you know, I think a lot of them, you know, believed that it would be for a short time. But I think part of them was also had to have been saying, maybe.
Right.
Maybe
right.
it's not for a short time.
That's
and
right.
for some families, it wasn't for a short time. For some families, it was. For some families, it was a couple months, and the parents got out somehow. But for other families, it was years. It was years.
Right.
And
that's right.
And you know, when you got that many people involved, I don't want to, you know, hold something up as a pattern. And when the Pedro Pan children reunited with their parents, here's what happened, because everybody was in a different situation. You had kids who were 7 and 8, and you had kids who were 17 and 18. You had kids who were separated for 2 months. You had kids who were separated for 4 years. You know, you had kids who went to foster families in Montana, and you had kids who just, you know, lived in Miami, and they came when they were 16 and just, you know, ended up staying in Miami. So, I mean, the... you know, everybody's story is very different, and you really can't find a solid pattern to say this is what happened to them, because you know, they all had different experiences.
That's right. What I find amazing to me, you know, when I think of 14,000 children, many of them were teenagers. So I think it would have been easier to tell a 15 or 16 year old young man or young woman, look, we're going to send you to the United States to study. That was more comprehensible, I would think. Even though a lie is probably too strong a word, but even though it was a cover. But when you're talking about children who are 6 and 7, and there were children who were that age, when you did your breakdown, did you break it down by age? I don't remember.
No.
Like, for example, how many were teenagers,
but
how many were under 10?
Right. No, but I can tell you that a very large percentage, and I have it here somewhere, so as I'm talking, I'm going to be looking through stuff, Operation Pedro Pan Group has the number, and I think it's a number that surprises a lot of people, of what percentage were teenage boys. And although, yes, there were a lot of younger children. There were a lot of, you know, 10-ish, is, you know, 11, 12 as well.
Right.
But a disproportionate number were teenage boys, because they were the ones in Cuba who were in the greatest danger. There was a military draft in Cuba, which had never existed before. I believe the draft age was 16. And the parents didn't want these kids serving in the military, period. That just wasn't a Cuban tradition, and much less in Fidel Castro's military. So that became a big incentive. Also, remember, teenage kids were really targeted by the regime for brainwashing. And, of course, if you were against the government and you opposed the government as a teenager, the penalties weren't much different to what they were for adults, which was extreme. And so that put them in a very precarious situation. Look, I have it here. Of the kids, the half of the kids who didn't have relatives in the United States, so of the 7,000 children, of the 7 of the 14,000 who had to enter the care of the Catholic Welfare Bureau, it says here 85% were between 12 and 18.
Hmm.
And 70% of the were boys over the age of 12.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, they were in a – now, that's not of the total number. That's just of the half that entered the Cuban
Sure.
According to this statistic from Operation Pedro Pan Group, which I would assume is correct. But, yeah, there were a lot of adolescent boys who were part of this. And, again, they were in a much more dangerous position than other children. You know, although there were a lot of 6-year-olds, 9-year-olds, and 10-year-olds as well.
That's right, and I was just going to say something for some in the audience who may not know the context of what was happening in Cuba at the time. I would say read Victor's books. I would say that would be a good lesson for you. But just quickly, what was happening in Cuba at the time was that the government was in an indoctrination campaign, and they would take your kids, whether they were young or of military age, and it wasn't so much to serve in the military, although that was part of it, Victor, but I think a lot of it was just indoctrination. They wanted to they wanted to train the new generation of Cubans.
Absolutely.
And they would take
young
people. And
that applied to all the children. Right. Yeah.
That's right. So they wanted to, and I think I was too young to qualify for that, I guess, at the time, but I remember hearing it from my parents, and we had a neighbor in our neighborhood who got caught up in that. So it was just a very difficult time. And going back to your numbers for a second, because you know there's a huge difference between a 16-year-old boy and a 12-year-old boy in terms of separation from your parents. I mean, you know, so at 16, you can live with other boys, or maybe live with your parents or your relatives or whatever. When you're 12, though, I think you're still very attached to your parents. I'm not sure that at age 12 it would be that easy to separate a boy from his mom and dad.
Right.
And yet many of them didn't. Another thing too that I found, not just from your book, from talking to stories like Amarilis, Rassler, and Nilda Cepero, and others that we've had on the show who were Pedro Pans. Another thing, too, is very common for an older sister to leave with maybe a younger sister and a little brother or something. I mean, sort of like the older sister was sort of became sort of like the mom, you know, if you will, for these younger kids. I found that to be such a fascinating story. And the level of maturity that these young women had to exercise. There's one lady here in Dallas who comes to my mind who was in that situation where all of a sudden you took this 15, 16-year-old Cuban young woman raised as a typical Cuban young woman of the time. Now all of a sudden she had a little brother and little sister in Miami that she was taking care of, maybe not so much economically but emotionally. I think that, man, that in itself is a story right there.
Right. Well, you're right. And a lot of times older siblings, you know, were charged. And again, that's another very, very, very common story. Older siblings all of a sudden at the last second being charged with protecting the younger ones, you know, and in my novel, in book three, well, really at the end of book two and throughout book three, that's one of the big themes, you know, among the siblings. And you're right, as a young woman was raised in Cuba, which, you know, a lot of the middle class up, I mean, you know, weren't raised to survive on the street, right? I mean, they were, you know, they were strong, they were intelligent, they were very educated and being prepared for a certain type of life. And the things they were being prepared for didn't include being a refugee in a foreign country, you know, but that's what, you know, history gave them. And a lot of them were very, very, very brave and protected their younger siblings. And a lot of them found themselves powerless because sometimes, you know, there were efforts, not efforts, but, you know, just part of, you know, the, you know, matter-of-factly they were going to separate them because of different, you know, ages, et cetera. And, you know, a lot of them fought for that not to happen. A lot of them fought successfully, a lot of them not. So, yeah, I mean, they definitely, you know, you had 14-year-olds and 16-year-olds and even 12-year-olds, you know, sort of taking on an adult role. You know, and shouldering an adult burden, you know, before they were really ready, but circumstances forced them to do it. And a lot of those kids, especially the ones who came as teenagers, when their parents finally came, you know, let's say it was a 16-year-old who came or a 15-year-old came in 1961 and their parents got out in, you know, 1965. That 16-year-old is now a 20-year-old and has been on his own for 2 years. And maybe at some university somewhere and already figured out how to live in this country. And then their parents come, you know, to take care of them. But really what ended up happening was that the child ended up taking care of the parents and helping the parents get adjusted. And this is how you do things. And I've already figured it out. So, yeah, a lot of kids grew up in a hurry. I mean, their formation was put into fast forward.
And it was surviving.
It was surviving. And a lot of them, you know, became stronger, and a lot of them, you know, and, you know, some of them I know, you know, are going to have to deal with those issues later. You know, some of the things they went through, not all of them, because, again, like I said, you cannot say this is typical Pedro Pan, because there were so many different ages, circumstances. But, you know, I mean, I know of a few who just didn't deal with certain feelings when they were teenagers, and they were separated because they couldn't, because they had, you know, they had too much to do. They had, you know, too many responsibilities suddenly. They had to survive. They had to ensure, you know, survival of younger siblings, you know, keep everything together. So, you know, you kind of repress, you know, whatever you're going through, and then eventually, you know, you deal with it later. But that's natural. You know, that's anybody who would have gone through anything like that, you know, that's natural. And never going back to your old life. Your old life was gone.
And, that's right. And,
you know, they were almost like, you know, that first generation of immigrants, you know, the pioneers, and, you know, in blazing that trail for their families. And they did it at a very young age. And a lot of them were very brave, and it was very admirable what a lot
and,
of them
and
did.
They did a good job. I think that's the other thing. It always reminds me, I know when we first came to the United States, there was a television show. It wasn't on that long, but it was called The Shenandoahs. And it was a Shenandoah family traveling through the Old West, you know, on crossing basically the Old West, you know, and the parents were lost in an accident. So you had this this young woman, sort of the big sister, and the brother raising this family basically, and that always to me was kind of like a lot of the Pedro Pan story is how these people grew up, and they did really a very nice job. And when you look, you know, look back at it now, 14,000 kids. Most of them have done rather well. Many, in fact, have been pretty famous. Dr. Carlos Heyde, who wrote a couple of books. Willy Chirino, I didn't realize he was a Pedro Pan. That's the other thing, too, Victor, that it seems like the more I get into Pedro Pan, the more that I discover Pedro Pans, you know? The more that I discover people. I was at a baseball game a year ago with a friend of mine here, invited me to a game, and I'm sitting there talking to him. He's a bit older than me, but anyway, we're sitting there talking, and we're talking about when we first came from Cuba, and he said that he came here as a kid in the early 60s. You know, they put him in a plane. He was, I guess at the time, he would have been 17 or 18, and I said, well, you were a Pedro Pan. And he looked at me, and he said, what's that? I said, Pedro, yep. I explained it to him. Typical. And then I referred him to the website and to your book and all of that, but it just seems like, you know, the more you learn about Pedro Pan, the more fascinating and mesmerizing it gets. And that's why I think this is a topic that is going to create a lot of interest down the road. But of the 14,000 kids who came, can you give us some examples of maybe what they're doing or any that really stand out in your mind?
Well, you know what? I think that the names that we know are the celebrities and the politicians, which are the names of the, you know, people we normally know. But I could tell you a lot of them that I know that are, you know, lawyers, physicians, architects, very successful, just not, you know, in the media. And people in all sorts of walks of life, builders, it was a very successful generation. Career-wise and all of that, and they had to struggle. And I think their children's generation is going to be probably even more successful, from all indications, from what I could see. And they really, you know, they really set that tone professionally. A lot of them couldn't go to college, but a lot of them did, and a lot of them became college graduates and figured it out. And have done remarkably well. And, you know, I mean, Cuban Americans in general from the early 60s have been extremely successful, unusually successful. And even the generations before the Pedro Pan, is even people who came in their 30s and 40s during that time, some of them made it. But, I mean, I think the real breakthrough generation across the board was, you know, that Pedro Pan generation. And some even, you know, a generation above them. But, yeah, no,
right.
I mean, the number of people I've met who are, you know, successful professionals is it's an endless list. I could, you know, give you anecdote after anecdote.
No, I know. But I think what's amazing to me, Victor, is the Cuban immigration is roughly about 1 million people, maybe slightly less than 1 million. Let's say 1 million for the just the easy number. And yet these 14,000 kids have had such an impact on mm-hmm. on the Cuban American name and the generation in general, and I am so impressed with the story of Pedro Pan. And now you have these anniversaries, you know, 50 years, 52. Many of them are, you know, you read about in the Pedro Pan website, and you see notices in Facebook. This fellow is passing away. I mean, many of them are in their 70s and. You know, we have a friend. There's a Pedro Pan, California. You know, Arturo Bueno, who left Cuba. I think he was 18 years old when he left Cuba, so he's probably close to 70 now. So you begin to have that generation who are now grandchildren, grandparents.
Yeah.
I mean, and what I find fascinating is every Pedro Pan that I've ever spoken to, and this is a big generalization, I know, but it's pretty close. Every Pedro Pan that I've ever spoken to is really committed in telling the story to his children and grandchildren. It's almost like they don't want people to forget the story. They really want their children and grandchildren to know how we got here and how it all happened. And so,
well, you know what? But
that's
fascinates
kind of
like me. Big veterans, you know, I mean, it could go either way. Some of them want to tell the story, and some of them don't want to revisit that story. And, you know, all my books are concerned with collecting stories. And some people you could tell have told the story 1,000 times, and others, they don't want to reopen that wound, and they don't like telling the story. And I've interviewed people about the Mariel boat lift. I've interviewed people about Pedro Pan, about the Bay of Pigs. And more than once, people have told me, you know, you're the first person I tell this story to. I haven't even told my children. And I'm like, wow. You know, so it could really go either way. But, you know, you asked about successful Pedro fans, you know, just a couple came to mind. Armando Codina, who's, you know, one of the most famous builders in Miami. Eduardo Padron. Padron is the president of Miami-Dade College and has chaired, you know, numerous education committees in the White House, et cetera. He's the head of the flagship community college system in the United States. You know, again, those are just two that popped into mind, you know, beyond the politicians and the you know, entertainers, et cetera. So it all depends on the person. Getting back to the issue of, you know, telling the story. Some people, you know, are very tight about that story because in telling the story, they have to relive part of it. And, you know, some didn't tell it for years and now tell it all the time because it turned out to be therapeutic for them to tell it. I mean, it was a hard thing that they went through. And if you look at, you know, so many people over so many generations, whether it's the Mario Boatlift people or the Pedro Pan people or the Bay of Pigs people or some of the refugees who didn't fall into any category of a historical event. They were just among the refugee population. I mean, the number of tragic stories is amazing. And I always say you can measure what happened in Cuba when you contemplate the fact that the Cuban people, to a certain extent, have become a people of camps. Since the revolution, right? You had the children's camps in Operation Pedro Pan. You had the training camps for Brigade 2506. You had the camps at Guantanamo. You had the camps for the Mario refugees. You know, as part of Castro's totalitarianism, you had camps where they sent children to the countryside to work and to be indoctrinated. You had camps called UMAPs in the 1960s and 70s, which were concentration camps where they sent, adolescents who weren't adapting to communism, you know, and it always, you know, it finally dawned on me one day, you know, half the people I've talked to spent time in one type of camp or another. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. I don't know anybody who spent time in camps except for maybe Boy Scouts previous to 1959. And it just seems whether you were on the exile side or, you know, on the side being repressed in Cuba. You know, a lot of people spend time in camps. I mean, it's just been an amazing thing. Unfortunately, you know, it could have been a lot worse because they simply could have taken all the Cuban refugees arriving in the United States and stuck them all in refugee camps if they'd done with other groups. It wasn't done. But even with that not being a policy, the number who were in camps is just astounding.
Right. No, I just think this is this Pedro Pan story is a story that is going to get bigger as time passes because I can foresee at some time in the future, you know, some 25-year-old professor in Cuba, just like you had an interest in it, taking an interest in the story. And I can see books and seminars being done about this story, and books, obviously, like yours, will be a big part of it. But I think the legacy, let me tell you what I think the legacy is, and I'd like to hear your thoughts, but I think the legacy of Pedro Pan is that you sometimes don't know what's really inside of you until you're tested. And when you see a lot of these young people, these young women, these young men who had to really, from one day to another, become young adults. I mean, they were your typical 15, 16-year-old young woman in Cuba. Now, all of a sudden, you're sitting in Miami with a little brother and a little sister, and you realize that this little brother and little sister of yours are really dependent emotionally on you. I think that, to me, is sort of the legacy that how well these young men and women did under pressure. Yes, some didn't succeed, some got in trouble, but the overwhelming majority of them did very well and are a real credit to their families and to all of us. That's one legacy. The other legacy is that this is just another chapter in a glorious Cuban-American story, and I know for me personally that as I started getting older, I really started getting more and more interested in the Cuban-American story. You know, we first came here, we got into the United States for a while. We never talked about Cuba. I spent almost 20 years not talking about Cuba. And then all of a sudden, you catch on, you begin to realize where you come from. And then now it's a real hunger. I cannot get enough information about, you know, Cuba, whether it's books like yours or books like Fernando's or Amarilis or whatever. Yeah, I cannot get enough. So that's kind of for me, those are the two legacies. What a great job these young people did. Go ahead.
I think maybe part of what happened to you is probably what happened to a lot of people that, you know, at one point certain things were, you can put it under the category of current events. And at one point, current events become history. and you look at history with a very different eye than you do current events, right? I mean, certainly if you were in Miami, say, during the Mariel boat lift, it was a current event, right? Now you look back, and it's, what, 34 years ago. Now it's a part of
history. Hard to believe. That's hard to believe. 34 years ago.
You were part of it. Yeah. It was 1980. And so, or, you know, the Bay of Pigs 50-some-odd years ago. You know, it goes from being a current event or a recent current event or a current event that's still alive to, with the passage of time, you know, becomes history that, you know, and not only history, but a part of history that your life was very directly affected by. Even those of us who were born here, you know, you start to develop a sense of, wow, everything that happened there, you know, had an impact on me and what I was surrounded by in my childhood, in why I was raised where I was raised and in the circumstances I was raised. Even though I wasn't born in Cuba, I didn't live through any of these things that I write about, you start to realize that, yeah, they had an impact on, you know, why, and, you know, I was raised, you know, the way I was and where I was raised and around whom I was raised, and all those formative forces in my life, and people like me, and, you know, God knows a countless number of people like me, had everything to do with those events that, you know, that immediately preceded my birth by only, you know, a few years. And I think that many people in my generation, or everybody in my generation, can say the same thing.
Absolutely. I think the Cubans like yourself who were born in Miami, you, even though you were not born in Cuba, nevertheless, that growing up in Miami in the 60s and 70s, I mean, you were so much that little Havana feeling where everything was was Cuba. It was all around you, your family.
Sure.
Well, I want to thank you, Victor, for joining us today. Interesting book that you wrote. Oh, my pleasure. This is a great topic, and we'll come back to it at another time. And obviously, when your new book is out, let me know, and we'll have you back. But I just find this Pedro Pan topic to be so interesting because now you were saying this was the largest one. You mean the next largest one? Because I thought that the Spanish Civil War also had a huge,
Western
number
hemisphere.
Of kids, right?
Yeah, it had the status of being the largest in the Western Hemisphere. But I think now what's going on in your neck of the woods at the border, if it's classified as a refugee crisis, you know, certainly there's more than 14,000. I think that. I don't know how to classify that yet. I don't know what they're classifying it as yet. It's still very murky exactly what's going on and what happened and what stimulated it. But, you know, but at the time of Pedro Pan, and even if it, you know, if it's, you know, moves into number two, at the time it was, that we know of, the biggest in the Western Hemisphere. In the Spanish Civil War, I don't know that much about it, but I do know that, that, you know, a lot of the children were sent, you know, to Russia, et cetera, and out of Spain. But, you know, that occurred in Europe, and Lord knows how many refugee movements there were in Europe that involved more than 14,000 children. I mean, you have that whole killing field between Russia and Germany, you know, for two wars that, you know, absolutely decimated populations there between World War I, the Russian Revolution, the Russian Civil War, the Nazi conquest of Eastern Europe, the Holocaust.
Right.
I mean, you had a lot of, you know, death there. You know, maybe I don't know where it ranks, but it has to be among, you know, the highest number of people killed in all of history within that time period. So I would imagine there was a great number of unaccompanied children, refugees during that time as well, although I'm not very aware of the numbers.
Well, I think that, you know, all throughout history, of course, children have been victims, often victims of cruelty and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I can appreciate that. But I think what makes Pedro Pan so unique, of course, we're close to it. You and I are close to the story.
Right.
That's what makes it interesting in that sense, emotional attachment to it. But also
sure.
It's the fact that for Latin America, Latin America has had some pretty nasty dictatorships over the years, but there had never been a dictatorship right or left that had motivated parents to put their kids in a plane. So, I mean,
exactly. Most of the dictatorships, you know, affected mostly people who were involved in politics. But you know, in many Latin American dictatorships, Cuba included, if you were detached from the political system, you could pretty much live a private life and, you know, not have to worry about it. And, I mean, of course you had to worry about it, but, I mean, you know, it was never anything where your life was so deeply impacted that you suddenly, as an ordinary person who's never expressed a political ideology, is suddenly in a dangerous political position just because of who you are.
Right.
That had never happened, not in Cuba, not anywhere else, you know, I can imagine, you know, unless you were some kind of an activist who was a threat to the government. But in Cuba, you know, I'm sure 99% of Pedro Pantoja's
right.
families were really, you know, under normal circumstances would have been no threat, but they were a threat to Castro because of what he was trying to do. This was Cuba's middle class. This was the large class of people who simply was not going to adapt to the revolution, was not going to accept communism.
Right, they were also talking about indoctrinating children. That had never happened. For example, if you look at whether it's Pérez Jiménez in Venezuela or Somoza in Nicaragua or whatever dictator you want to bring up, they had never gone after children the way Castro went after children. I think that
there was never systematic brainwashing.
Right,
there was never, and this was political indoctrination almost with a radical religious zeal. Right, you had to trade in all your beliefs that you ever possessed and get rid of them and replace them with a revolutionary ideology that affected every area of life, you know, and every area of life that anything you believed in, you know, had to be discarded, which made it very different from everything else. I mean, you know, even if you were, you know, religious or you had whatever ideology, you simply couldn't do it, and you and after a certain point, you couldn't even leave. You were trapped in that, and if you didn't go along, then your life would be very difficult, to say the least.
Right, and there's another sad chapter, or sad part to the Pedro Pan story. The kids who never saw their parents again, because some of their parents, like for example, in the case of Dr. Carlos Zeta, his dad just died in Cuba. He never saw him again. But in the case of others. A small group of these parents were put in jail, or they were, you know, killed by the Castro government, and they never saw their parents again. Which I think, I don't care how much time has passed. Anybody who went through an experience like that, the pain still has to be there. Idea that you would never see your parents again has got to be there, but. Anyway, it's just a great story, Victor, and I'm so happy that you wrote about it, because I think you must have been one of the early books in this topic.
Mine was the first. Mine was
the first
book written about it. The first one published about it. There were a couple. I think there were other books in the works, but mine was the first one that was released. So,
aren't you glad as a Cuban American? Aren't you glad that so many Cubans and are writing about their stories of coming to the United States? I always wanted Cubans to do that, and I sort of had that reason myself. But you think of so many others, and Lorenzo Martinez, I had him on the show recently. He just wrote a book about coming to the United States. It seems to me more and more Cubans ought to do this, because we're not
definitely.
Just
and in November we're holding an event with the Pedro Pan group where we're going to encourage people to do just that and to write their personal histories. But I've always found that as, you know, again, this reservoir of incredible stories, because just growing up, you know, you hear the stories. Maybe when you're younger, you're more concerned with the school dance or something, but it always captivated us. And then, you know, when I started researching and I decided to take this as my field, and I wrote the Pedro Pan book, I realized that the most riveting part for me were people's stories, and of course, you know, I realized very quickly, you know, what people always said: every Cuban has a story. Up here, I live, you know, in New England, you know, I tell people my family story, which is, you know, not, you know, the worst. I mean, they, you know, they went through a lot, but not anywhere close to what some other families went through, with people in political prisons and you know other people in prison and this, that, and the other. And they're just riveted listening to it, and really it's not that extreme. But, you know, I liked the story part, and so my subsequent books involved a lot more oral history, and there's nothing that thrills me more than setting up an interview with someone and going to talk to them, because anyone you speak to, every single one, and I have all the tapes here, you listen to these stories, and most of them are just ordinary people, and it's just captivating and dramatic. And you know that you can walk, you know, and run into any, you know, Cuban who came from Cuba whether it was whether they came on a raft in the 90s or in the Mario boat lift, or whether they came Pedro Pang, or they came as part of the refugees of the early 60s or on the freedom flights. And you know that if you sit them down and you say, tell me your story, right, it's going to be something that'll make your breath stop. And,
right.
And you can pick anyone. You go to a shopping center in Miami, just grab someone and say, tell me your story. And I think most people would be absolutely intrigued and horrified and everything else by it.
Well, what I find most fascinating.
That's what I do.
That's right. But what I find most fascinating about these stories, whenever I have a chance and I meet somebody from Cuba of my parents' generation who left at that time, I always try to inquire a little bit about their story. What amazes me is that even though the stories have similar characteristics, the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution and stuff like that,
right.
But everybody seems to have, it's almost like pop music. If you look at the top 40 songs, they all tend to use
right.
the same chords, but they all sound different somehow. And I
right.
think that that's the way these stories are, that even though,
yeah.
the same
yeah,
notes, the same
analogy.
Chords, they
right.
all have a different sound to them. But we're going to have to wrap
yeah.
it up, Victor. But again, thank you
okay.
so much for your time and
you,
keep
Silvio.
Up the great work. And you let me know when this book is ready because we'll have you back. This will be the third chapter, right, of your trilogy.
Yeah, this will
so
be book three.
The book three. So I'm looking forward to what time frame is that going to be, like the missile crisis a little bit later?
Well, this is, book two ended when the two children of the family leave Cuba.
Right.
In July, I timed everything, and it took some creativity on my part and some, and a lot of research to pick the perfect moment for them to leave. But what I picked was mid-July when, early on after the invasion, there were negotiations
right.
for the release of the brigade. And those early negotiations, and when the negotiations were going on, they were, the brigade was put into halfway decent conditions at the Naval Hospital, I think in the eastern part of Havana. And then when the negotiations collapsed, then they were put into the, into a dreadful colonial-era Spanish prison. And then I picked that moment when the main character gets to that prison, and at the same moment his children are being sent to the United States. And as soon as this guy gets to his dungeon, the kids are showing up in the United States and starting their new life, and the wife is in Cuba by herself. And so, the story kind of ends there. And here in book three, it picks up right there.
It picks up at that point, yes. Yeah, so,
and it
goes
great. All the way through December 1962.
All right, which then that would include the missile crisis. But
yeah.
Victor, thank you so much again. Have a great weekend, and hopefully next year when you and I chat, the Yankees and the Rangers will have better seasons.
Yeah, let's hope so. Okay,
hope
Silvio.
So, because it's been a horrible baseball season for us here in Texas, and I know the Yankees are doing better, but not too much better.
But
have a good day, Victor, and thanks for the great work you've done.
Okay, thank you, Silvio, for having me on again. I appreciate it.
All right, my pleasure. Victor Trey, the author of the Pedro Pan book that we talked about today, several other books that he's written about Cuba, including this trilogy of books about a family leaving Cuba. The third one, as he mentioned, will be out soon, and then we'll have a chance to catch up. But this is a time in Cuban history, the early 60s, when a lot of stuff was happening, a lot of stuff was impacting the average Cubans. And the Pedro Pan program that included 14,000 children was in its high point. And Victor was the first one to write about this in the late 90s. And now, of course, Pedro Pan, there's an organization in Miami. There's lots of other Pedro Pans. And more each day, more and more Cubans are realizing that they were part of something called Pedro Pan. For a long time, a lot of kids just knew that they had left the country, but they didn't realize that they were part of a larger group that became known as Pedro Pan. Well, that's going to do it for today, folks. Thank you so much for listening. Again, my thanks to Victor Trey. Thanks to all of you in Facebook who are sharing the show. I appreciate that, as we always do. Have a wonderful day, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and I'll leave you with the music of Carlos Guedes.